Okay,
so far in the Gospel of Mark, we've been putting our lens into place. That's been what this whole first week and a half's been about. Dealing with the author, dealing with the date, dealing with the first verse. The whole goal has been to put a lens in place so that we will know how to read the rest of the book of Mark. That's the point. Has everybody followed that so far? I hope so. I apologize for yesterday's lecture. I had a bad teaching day yesterday. I'm hoping today will be a little better. So forgive me if it was boring. But the goal has been to put a lens in place so that we know how to read the rest of the book. And so far, obviously we've done the date and we're not going to revisit that conversation. We've done the author. But I do want to revisit a little bit on verse 1. We've looked at it through two lenses, which is, what is one of the lenses we've looked at it through? The Jewish lens. The second lens was the Roman lens. Exactly. From the Jewish lens, this is saying some pretty substantial things. New creation talk. In the beginning. Oh, that sounds familiar. The gospel, the euangelion, the establishment of God's kingdom, about Jesus, the anointed one, the king, the son of God, the representative, the one that will rule on the throne of David. That's the Jewish perspective. Then you look at it from the Roman perspective, and they're going, hold on, the beginning of everything, of all creation, according to the Priene calendar inscription, was the birth of Augustus. Using the same words like euangelion and arche, and even calling him soter, savior. Using this type of language, but right off the bat, a Roman read this and say, you're claiming something that we have claimed for our own emperor, who is in fact the Son of God, according to the Romans. So this initial verse, from two perspectives, is politically charged. Politically charged. The Jews may get excited about the language being spoken here, while the Romans could be deeply offended. However, once you throw in the name Jesus, the Jews would probably be in agreement with Rome. You see how that works? This is the lens through which we are going to be reading the rest of this book. Why? Mark 1:1 tells me so. He starts off his book with the reason. It's one of the things that I learned from Jeff Snell whenever I was taking him for my preaching class. He used to be a professor here before a 6-year hiatus, and now he's back. Yahoo! But he always told me, he always told our class, he was talking to me. He always would say, though, he said, when it comes to preaching, Shane, your opening line is more important than your closing line. Because a lot of times we'll spend just hours and all kinds, well, maybe not hours, but a lot of time on crafting the right words for the closing line to really hammer it home. But he used to always say, it's the opening line that you need to spend the most time on. Because that is going to either bring people into the sermon, or it's going to let them loose. And so you'll never hear me walk up on any sermon, because of Jeff Snell's advice, you'll never hear me walk up on any sermon and just say, hey, how's it going? What's going on? Or tell a little meaningless, disconnected joke. Because my very first words are the ones they will hear the loudest. It's just the way it is. Because I'm going to be talking for the next 25 to 30 minutes, and they're going to miss a lot of words within that. But they're going to hear my first words, and they're going to be looking for my last words. Either because I'm boring them or because they're tracking. They're going to be looking for the last words. Thanks, Natalia. I appreciate that. I do. you see what I'm saying? The first words of the Gospel of Mark. You've got to pay attention to them. It's what he starts right out of the gates with. And we are tempted, once we move to verse 2, to think that now we've switched topics. Why? Well, let me read verses 2 through 3, which is where we're going to spend most of our time today. And we'll talk about that in a minute. It says, it is written in Isaiah the prophet, I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way, a voice of one calling in the desert. Prepare the way for the Lord, make straight paths for him. It is tempting to think that now he has switched topics from verse 1. Like you're thinking, okay, Shane, let's just pretend that we buy your whole politically charged verse 1 thing, whatever. But now we're getting to the spiritual stuff. Now we're getting to a new topic. He's going to start talking about the spiritual reality, something that the political thing just gets in the way of. What's wrong with that perspective? What's wrong? Yes?
All ancient authorities came out of spiritual backing, like spiritual authority.
Yeah, there is two ways we could approach why that is a wrong statement, what I said. That now we've switched topics in verse 2 to the spiritual. Number one, we could take a linguistic argument. And number two, we could do the sociological one, the sociopolitical argument, or the religio-political argument, I guess would be the more accurate term. Let's do the linguistic one first. What is, does anybody have a Greek text? What is the first Greek word of verse 2? Huh? Anybody have one? No? No Greek scholars? Nothing? What? Help me, Colby.
Verse 2?
Yes, verse 2. Kathos. What does it mean? Kathos? Isn't that what you said?
Yeah.
What does it mean? Just as. Even as. What is that type of language? What is it doing to what's come before? It's connecting it, isn't it? He used this political statement, the beginning of the gospel about Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And then he says, just as it is written. Now that's not in my NIV, but that's in the Greek. A connecting word which says, we're not switching topics. I'm actually going to expound on that topic. Isn't that what just as does? Yes? You awake? Holler if you hear me. Hey, okay. Just as linguistically, we're not shifting topics. Now, religio-politically, sociologically speaking, we're not either. Because Justin is correct. In our world, we have this concept of the separation of church and state. We have this concept, and you'll hear it a lot in the next year or so. Why? What's happening in the next year or so?
Election.
Yeah, election time. And it's going to be coming up a lot. Why? Why will it come up in our election time? What's the main discussion of the separation of church and state that you'll hear out of presidential candidates' mouths? What's that?
Is it gay?
Well, maybe. Yeah, there's some of the topics that come from that. But one of the key things that they'll talk about is, well, my faith is private, but it won't affect any of my legislation. Why? Why are they saying that? Because in our society, we keep church and state separate. I mean, it makes sense abstractly, although practically it's somewhat of a odd at best. Anyway, doesn't matter. Bottom line is, we in our society, we think church and state are totally a part of separate realms. That's not the ancient world at all. As a matter of fact, Rome believed that the reason why they were in the position they were in was because of their favor of the gods. The gods are the ones that have ordained divinely for Rome to be the rulers of the world. And as a result, the way in which Rome worships the gods, even the emperor himself being a part of the gods, son of God anyway, the way that they worship the gods directly affected their political prosperity. Directly. Because if the gods put you in the place, that means if you tick them off, what will the gods do? Remove you out of that place. See how that makes sense? Church and state in no way, shape, or form in the ancient world are separate at all. They're inextricably linked. For when you start talking about spiritual things, inevitably it moves to political realities. Because the gods used their empires as pawns on the world. So if you tick off a god, you may lose your position of power. Which is one of the reasons why, whenever Rome was very first coming to be, around the time of the Republic, every time that they would conquer a city or conquer a people, they would graft that god, the key patron god of that city, into their pantheon. Because basically what they were saying was this: your god obviously likes us better. Otherwise you wouldn't have lost. See how that works? Church and state is not separate. Therefore, if we talk something political in verse 1, and we move to what appears to be spiritual stuff in verse 2, the ancient world would not see it. They would see that as a logical connection. Does that make sense? What are we doing? We're trying to get the right lenses on so that we can see the passage more clearly. Because if you look at the Bible through the separation of church and state, you're going to miss a lot of what's being said. Now, you'll probably still understand the resurrection, okay? But you'll miss it. A lot of times people, the explanations of why Jesus was crucified a lot of times are silly. I'm going, hello, if you understood what he was saying, of course he'd be nailed to a tree eventually. Rome's not going to tolerate that. You can't have somebody running around saying, I'm the Son of God, and then proving it by healing people and gathering a big massive group, especially in the desert region around the time of Passover, where people are heralding you as a king as you come into the city of David. You see what's happening? You put the lens on of Rome and you're going, oh yeah, that guy's dead in the water. They just didn't anticipate him to rise back up. Anyway, that's another issue. Yes?
It's pretty normal, like, in any religious belief for people to practice it but not take it seriously. Do you think that most people actually believe that there were gods, or was it just something that you did?
Couple of assumptions in that statement. It's possible for people not to take their religion seriously. However, we're evidence that that's not normally true. And I would even say, yeah, man, because of our positions of what we're able to do for ourselves as one of the richest countries in the history of the world. Granted, I understand where our economy's at right now. I get it. I'm just saying, let's, in comparison, we can be involved in things like religions that we don't think has a direct impact on us. One of the reasons why is because we dichotomize once again between church and state. Private faith, public reality. The rest of the world doesn't really function like that. A lot of their religions are based on whether or not their crops will grow or not. They don't take that lightly. A lot of, like with Rome especially, the prosperity of the entire empire of a city is directly connected to a god. You don't flippantly deal with the gods. It's not superstition, it's belief in what is beyond us because we can't do everything ourselves.
At the same time, I grew up in East Africa, and I mean, mm-hmm. There's plenty of Muslims that don't take
absolutely
Islam seriously whatsoever. Is it possible that there were people, I mean, even especially within Rome, there were very wealthy people that, you know, didn't have a lot to worry about. Do you think that maybe there was, I mean, they would have been the ones in authority as well. So I wonder, mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that they really took it all as seriously?
Am I going to say every one of them took it as seriously as everybody else? No, I can't say the statement either way. That's what I'm saying, is that the answer rests more in the middle. Can I find extremes on both ends? Absolutely. However, whenever religion is inextricably linked into the everyday life, it becomes a lot harder to ignore. Not because they just have to do the right rituals, but because they believe that the veil between the physical world and the unspiritual world is a lot thinner than what we believe today. They do believe that what the gods do in the spiritual realm affects the physical world and vice versa. In a lot of regions, in Islam, in Christianity, we don't think that veil is very thin. We think it's quite thick. We think there's a major chasm between the physical realm and the spiritual realm. And they wouldn't see that chasm as big as what we have. It's much smaller. Why? Because what we do here affects them, and what they do up there affects us. They see it as a symbiotic relationship, where we see it as, no, we can do our thing down here, and every once in a while we can pay lip service, but there's not much of a connection. Because we're much more physical in the way in which we establish realities. Locke, we can thank Locke for that. John Locke. They weren't as much. That's one of the things I love about the book of Revelation, is that the whole point of it was to pull back the veil and say, see, it's not as thick as you might have thought it was. When everything is going chaotic and exploding, you have to understand, God's still moving. So is it possible that you have nominal people? Yeah, definitely. But even to be a part of a trade guild, if you wanted to be able to make money through a trade in the ancient world, you had to worship the patron deity of your trade. It was a part of every avenue of life. It was on their coins. It was on their architecture. It was in their marketplaces. It was every fabric of their life was integrated into some sort of religious reality. And that's not as much what we find today in our world. We have found a lot of different ways to insulate ourselves from having to pay attention to what's beyond us, which is one of the accomplishments of modernity. Be it good or bad, it's just that is. That's one of the things, that's one of its goals was to do that. It's to establish an absolute reality. And sorry, but you can't have absolute certainty in something you can't really see. Therefore, let's insulate ourselves as much as we can to eradicate that which we can't control. And so you see that pervasive. I think the nominalism is much more easily accessible in our world than theirs. That's the way I would word it. I'm not saying everybody in their world was hook, line, and sinker with the gods, but what I'm saying is it was much more integrated into their everyday life than what it is with ours. That's what I'm saying. Good question. Good question. Other thoughts on that? Other questions?
What's nominalism?
Nominal, basically just kind of like flippant. I go to church, but I don't really know Jesus. That's basically it. That's a good clarification question. Anything else? All right. So, we're still talking about political stuff is my main point. When we move to verse 2, the conversation hasn't shifted. It's now going to be expounded upon. And he does it by quoting, by actually weaving together three Old Testament texts. Three Old Testament texts. That could be a good test question, by the way. Three Old Testament texts. That's three times I've said that. Isn't that right? I think. Test. Three Old Testament texts. Number one. Exodus chapter 23, verse 20. This comes with the phrase, "I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way." That section of the quotation, now we're going to come to an anomaly here in a minute. I'm not skipping the introductory phrase. We'll come back to it. "I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way." That comes from Exodus chapter 23, verse 20. And Malachi 3, verse 1. Those two combine linguistically in order to make up that initial phrase. So you have, "I will send my messenger ahead of you who will prepare your way." You can find linguistically Exodus 23, 20 parallels that. And Malachi 3, 1. Now let me give you the context of those. Yes, hand raising.
What was the first reference in Exodus?
23:20.
Was it just 23:20?
Yes. These are the two. I haven't said the third one yet. In case you're wondering, I've only told you two. Exodus 23:20, Malachi 3:1. And those make up this first initial section of the quotation. Exodus 23:20, it's talking, the context is the conquest of the promised land. And what God is saying is He is sending His angel to prepare a way for His people, to prepare the promised land for them to lay siege over it. So what is that describing? What juncture in the history of Israel is that emphasizing? What's happening in that moment in Exodus 23:20? What's that? He's preparing them to move from the 40 years of wilderness into the establishment of their nation in an exact land. It's creation talk. Political establishment of a kingdom. You see how that follows? Malachi chapter 3 verse 1. This context is the prophet Malachi is describing the harbinger, the one, the forerunner of the messianic figure. And he is saying that one will go before him. Malachi 4:5 tells us the one is Elijah, which will play into John the Baptist's role eventually. But Malachi 3:1 says, "I'm sending one to prepare the way for my Messiah to come and establish what? The kingdom, the new creation, the liberation of the exiles." So what are the initial two Old Testament passages talking about? Exodus 23:20 and Malachi 3:1. What are they talking about? The establishment of a kingdom. Right? The establishment of the kingdom. Then we have this weird phrase, because in light of the fact that part of this is Exodus 23:20 and Malachi 3:1, then what do we do with the phrase, "It is written in Isaiah the prophet"? Oh, what? There's a couple of options here. Maybe number one, maybe Mark made a mistake. Maybe he thought it was all in Isaiah, he just didn't realize he was combining three texts. Come on. It always makes me laugh whenever people will point out stuff like this and they're like, "See the Bible, you can't rely on it." Really? Mark had no idea, listening to Peter, that what he was quoting was more than one text. What do you think he could be doing? What do you think he could be doing by pointing to Isaiah? We haven't talked about the third text of the Old Testament one, right? I'll give you a hint. That comes in Isaiah 40, verse 3. That's the third text that makes up the last half of this. But he introduces it by saying it's coming from Isaiah. What's his point? Help me. I'm not going to give you this answer. We're going to talk about it.
The Messiah has been foretold throughout the Old Testament. It's like continuing. It's the same message.
Yeah, maybe what he is saying is that, yeah, this is something that encompasses all the Old Testament. The only oddity would be that the time period of Isaiah would be right in the middle of Malachi and Exodus. Nevertheless, I could still see that point. Yeah, it is. It could be the same Messiah message from Exodus to Malachi. He could be saying that. Absolutely. What else? Isaiah maybe is summing up what both of them are saying. Yeah, I think that's part of it too. Absolutely. Any other things you can think of? Why would he be pointing to Isaiah when he quotes three texts? Those are both good. Yet maybe he's trying to point to an identity of Jesus, and I do think there's part of that as well. Because if you notice, the Exodus and the Malachi, they're talking about an establishment of a kingdom, but their focus seems to be more on the agent. The agent that is coming before the Messiah, don't they? But whenever you look at Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, it's not as focused on the agent as it is the mission. As it is not the one that's coming before the Messiah, but it's the actual Messiah and his identity and mission as a whole. I think he's talking to Isaiah because that's his main point. And he's using the other two to once again show this is a narrative that stretches all the way across the Old Testament. And it also is showing that what it has to do with is the establishment of the kingdom, something that God's been concerned with from the beginning. Nevertheless, the main point is what's coming in Isaiah. I think what he's saying is, let's look at this prophet even though we know this is a part of the Old Testament story. You can disagree with that, that's fine. However, to say that he just made a mistake, I think is a lot bigger of a stretch, personally. Not because I'm protecting inerrancy, but because I'm trying to be a good historian. where are we at? So, Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3. What is this actually saying? Sometimes, this is an important principle. Whenever you're looking at any quotation of the Old Testament in the New Testament, anytime, you have to understand these people were not ignorant of the Old Testament scriptures like a lot of our churches are, like a lot of us are. They knew it backwards and forwards. And a lot of times, whenever they say one quote, one passage, they have in mind the entire context that that passage was in, the entire story. This is what a lot of times in Romans gets us into trouble, is we think he quotes one passage and we just take that one passage and think that he's just ripping it out of context. But when you read it in the context of the entire story, it starts to actually make sense what the point is. And that's the same thing happening here with Isaiah 40 verse 3. Because what I'm going to read to you right now is actually Isaiah 39, 5 through 7. Because when we're running into Isaiah chapter 40, that's the most important part to see what he's talking about here by quoting at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark. So Isaiah 39, 5 through 7 says this. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your fathers have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon." Whoa, what's he saying? What's Isaiah pronouncing? Judgment on the people of God. He looks at Hezekiah, the king of the people of God, and he says, you need to understand what's about to happen. Everything in your palace will be gone. Why? It's going to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. From the perspective of a Jew, what is that saying? Think about that. Yeah. Our kingdom's being destroyed. And even mocked. Even God himself is somewhat being mocked. Why? Because if you read in Daniel 1, when this exile happens, what happens to the artifacts that were in the temple? They're taken and used in the pagan temples of Babylon. You see, you have to understand that if the state and the church are connected, then whenever anything negatively happens to the state or the nation of Israel, it affects the honor of the God that they serve. But because the nation of Israel is in such disarray, because they are so rebellious, their very existence is shameful for God. And so Isaiah comes along and he says, God's going to do something about that in Isaiah 39. He says, he's going to wipe you out. even your descendants, they'll become eunuchs, servants, priests in the temples of pagan gods. It doesn't get worse than that. But now let's read Isaiah chapter 40, verses 1 through 5. And verse 9. We'll throw in verse 9. Because why am I doing that? We read Isaiah 39. Now why am I reading Isaiah 40? What's that? Yeah. You need to get the whole context, the whole story of what he is quoting right here in Mark chapter 1, verses 2 through 3. Isaiah chapter 40, verses 1 through 5 says this. After the pronouncement of judgment in chapter 39, he says, "Comfort, comfort my people," says your God. "Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for, that she has received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice of one calling, 'In the desert prepare the way for the Lord, make straight in the wilderness a highway for our God.'" Sound familiar? "Every valley shall be raised up, every mountain and hill made low. The rough ground shall become level, the rugged places a plain. And the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all mankind together will see it. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken." And then in verse 9, he says this. He says, "You who bring good tidings to Zion, go up on a high mountain. You who bring good tidings to Jerusalem, lift up your voice with the shout. Lift it up and do not be afraid. Say to the towns of Judah, here is your God." What's this passage talking about? Keep it in the story. What? That was right. Restoration. Restoration of what? The kingdom of God. Isaiah chapter 39 says, because of your rebellion, you will be in exile. And guess what? Whenever they left Babylon, the exile didn't end. We've talked about that, right? The Jews were still looking for a Messiah to come and liberate them. They're still in exile whenever Jesus comes on the scene. In Isaiah 39, the pronouncement of judgment has not, they have not experienced Isaiah 40 yet. Isaiah 40 is a messianic passage because what it is saying is God has come to make things right, to restore a kingdom. You see why the Isaiah passage is what Mark would want to beeline to? He's saying, don't get me wrong, this is a story we've been talking about since the establishment of Canaan. God moves through His agents to prepare a place for you. Don't get me wrong, this isn't even what he was talking about in Malachi, you know, that whole one's coming. But let's get the whole story in perspective here. You're in exile because of your rebellion, Isaiah 39. But don't forget, Isaiah 40 is coming. And it's coming through what? Through whom? Through Jesus, through the King. You see, this is King language. Mark chapter 1, verses 2 through 3. Or let's just do verse 3. "A voice of one calling the desert, prepare the way for the Lord, make straight paths for Him." When a king was coming, what would you do? If he was coming to your city, what would you do? Yeah. Let's just do this. We were playing basketball this past summer, and all the PPD guys were all over the multipurpose building. And finally we were like, what's going on? They're like, oh, we're having to, you know, repaint everything and just kind of make sure it all looks good because there's a possibility that Laura Bush will be coming to the MPB. It ended up not happening for a series of reasons, but what were they doing? Preparing the place because someone of the status of royalty was coming. If you knew the king was coming to your city, you wouldn't just sit and do nothing. You would do what? Prepare the city in a way that shows how much the one that is coming to your city is worth. So what would you do? Especially to the roads, what would you do? Which were notoriously poor in the ancient world. What would you do? What was that? Yeah, you would make them smooth. You'd fill in all the holes that you know as a local how to dodge around. But you don't want your king to have to dodge around the holes of your city. So that looks bad on you and it says something poor about him. So you fill those in. What else do? You may even get extravagant and do something even crazier. Maybe you'll even make the roads that are twisty and turny straight. You're going to do whatever it takes to prepare the place for the coming of the king, because he's worth it. And Mark chapter 1, verses 1 through 3 says, a king is coming to establish a kingdom. And we are preparing a place, because this isn't just some random king. This is the king that will restore and will liberate the nation of Israel, the kingdom of God, from its exile. Something we've been talking about all throughout the Old Testament. Just ask the prophets. All right, I love you guys. I'll see you next class period. Tuesday.